This is the Brian Callen Show. All right, everybody, this is the Brian Callen Show, otherwise known as the Brian Callen Podcast. You're listening really in a lot of ways to the mother of all podcasts. This is the number one. I was rated number one podcast by the International Podcasting Association of Podcasts. I don't know why you're laughing, Patty, but and then the report recently came out that said that all the other podcasts, a very reliable report by the Wall Street Journal, saying that all other podcasts suck ass compared to mine, and I think that's unfair. So I'm not going to listen to my own press. Maybe it's just my brandy and soda voice, my very charismatic voice. Listen, I'm excited because sitting in front of me is none other than the great Patty Jenkins. You might not know her, but Patty's been my friend for 25 years. By the way, I've known you for 26 years.
I know.
Okay?
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. Talk into the mic, please. Yeah. I know you're not a stand-up comic. Yes. Patty is a director, and she wrote and directed a little movie called Monster, starring Charlize Theron. Charlize Theron won an Oscar for that. In my opinion, it was the greatest single, and I'm not kidding, single performance by a female in motion picture history. I really believe that. And I'm looking at a picture now, Patty, of you. You directed that. You just won a Directors Guild Award for directing The Killing, a pilot for AMC. And you've been doing all this while holding down a family, which is pretty amazing. But you're a very intense person.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I know you're writing a bunch of things, and I'm glad I got you on the podcast. I'm looking at a picture right now of you staring at Charlize Theron while she's naked, posing, that Richard Avedon took. Yeah. What was that in? What magazine?
The New Yorker.
You've been in The New Yorker? That's incredible! That's incredible!
The hilarious thing was that the only thing that really mattered about that movie, any success that movie was going to have, was that I get in The New Yorker and I'd be on Charlie Rose. Because as far as my family was concerned, I was like the superstar of all times. If either of those things happened, I was the most famous person in the history of the world.
That's exactly right.
Because that's all they care about.
Yeah, but that's a pretty big accomplishment. Because the one thing that you've done is, you know, a lot of people put up a lot of work. They throw a bunch of stuff up on a wall and hope something sticks. But you've been very particular about your expression and what you do. And you've said no to a hell of a lot more than you said yes to. And when most directors are out there trying to make a buck and saying yes to everything, I remember, and I'm not going to mention the name, but I remember being with you in Nantucket, and you were avoiding a very famous and powerful actor / producer / director because he wanted you to direct his movie, and you didn't want to say no to him. Do you remember that?
I do.
Yeah. So you're somebody who's actually shied away from movies, from directing things you don't really, that don't call to you. So maybe talk a little bit about that and why you're such a purist.
Well, you know, it's funny. I feel like it's not the, you know, I've tried to give this advice to people before, and it's not the best advice because it's not like I have, you know, have some incredible, you know, long-term career that I'm speaking from. So it's always very limited. But I think in Los Angeles, it's very easy in Hollywood to let other people define to you what success is. And I really feel like when I made Monster and it was a huge success, the world handed me a brass ring that was like, congratulations, now you can be a huge Hollywood director and make a lot of money in average movies, you know? And, you know, and that's a judgmental thing to say. The truth is, I never wanted to be a huge famous director. And so it was very confusing for a little while because at first you're like, oh, thanks, I won the prize. I won the chance to do this.
Well, let me interrupt you, because a huge famous director really is somebody who works 17 hours a day and has no life, right? I mean,
right, and also it's just the job. Like, I think that coming from the direction of having done photography and painting and then moving on to film, like, I kind of just want to make stuff that I believe in. So it was kind of confusing because they're handing you the brass ring and saying you get to make these things, but they were things that I didn't believe in, and they were all also something that's already too far down the road for me to believe I could change. So it's like already cast and it's already set up and the script is already written and I don't understand it, you know.
But you see, now you're touching on something. I'm sorry, you were...
No, that's it. I was just going to say it's been easy to say no in a way, because they're offering me money, or they were offering me money back when there still was money, but they're offering me money, but it's not to do something that I set out to do. It's okay, to take a job, which is to be a professional at directing movies, even if it's not what you actually believe is a good movie, you know?
Well, but see, now, because a lot of people listening to this are not directors and they don't have a context for it, but you're touching on something that I think is universal, and that is that it feels like whenever that you in your work you're trying to either, your work is either a rebuttal or a statement, or in some ways almost trying a sort of a cry in the dark. You're trying to fix something. You know, you made a painting when you were 19 or actually 17 that I loved. I don't know where it is, but it was this. It was
sitting
a, it
in
was
the
a,
other room.
It was of a head.
Oh no,
a guy coming out of the ground and just barely getting his head and neck out of the ground, going like screaming. It was like a howl. And it's a good metaphor for how you've always seemed to live your life, sort of like just, you know, sometimes you put it on yourself, but you've always been somebody who was dissatisfied with the status quo and wanted to have an answer for it, which I think you did with Monster. And, you know, you're respected for your work probably because you have a lot of that in you. Some people would call it integrity, but so I'm this is a long roundabout way of saying, what do you think that you're trying to figure out or solve or say with your work?
Well, it's funny because I think that that was very true with Monster, and I think that I tapped into some similar parts of myself to do The Killing. But I actually, and actually one of my next films may also have a big issue to, like, issue that I'm addressing to it. But really, I don't feel a burning axe to say something, I don't think. But what I do feel a burning desire to do is do something that I really believe in. So even if it's funny, you know, like even when I directed Arrested Development, it was funny. I loved it. Like, I loved what we were doing. I loved making those moments happen. I loved seeing that. So I feel like I just want to do genuine work that I think, like, definitely the craving that I think I have is to be really honest about some human experience. So oftentimes movies that feel good feel like they're saying something very short of that. Like, it feels like it's saying something.
So what drives you then is saying something very honest about a human experience.
Yeah, it's like,
because
it's
you've always had a huge heart. I remember when you came up with the idea for Monster, because you said to me, we watched the Eileen Warnes documentary separately, and I called you and I said, that girl was destroyed from a very early age. And she said she was made into a monster. She was made into a monster. And you've always had a real soft spot for convicts, because a lot of convicts can be people who were just brutalized when they were children, and they come out and they never had a goddamn chance.
Yeah.
And you always seem to be the kind of person that wants to give a voice to the forsaken and the forgotten and the disenfranchised and the marginalized. I think I'm right about that.
Yeah,
right?
I have no idea why that is. I'm sure there's, if we got into it, we could like pick apart, you know, life and what happens. But I definitely feel like, you know, it's funny, people who do
but you were
charity
a
work
like that though, Patty. I mean, you lost your dad when you were 8. You were moved around all the time. You never felt safe because your mother was wonderful, but your mother was just a mother trying to raise 2 daughters. And so you always felt vulnerable, probably, and not in a position to protect yourself. That's why you were pretty fierce when you were younger. You know, when I met you, you weren't hearing it from people. I remember you trying to fight guys in bars.
I know. Yeah, I think that's true. I think that probably what you're saying is true. My reaction to feeling afraid made me angry and more fearsome, right? That was my reaction. So as a result, I have always seen that in other people and in much more extreme examples. Eileen Warnes being one of them, and a lot of people in prison.
Eileen Warnes, by the way, for you guys, is the serial killer in Florida who she wrote about in Monster that Charlize Theron played.
Yeah. So really all it is I think that it bugs me. Like, the Eileen Warnes story gnawed at me. I never thought it would be a great movie. I never thought like that would be a great way to start one's career. But it always bugged me because you and I had that conversation. You and I have always both understood that, you know, a wide variety of what kind of behavior is possible. But you would run into these people over and over again who are like, she's a man hater. She hated men. She got off on killing. You're like, are you an idiot? Like, really? You look at that? That's what you see? I see a terrified creature backed into a corner. Like,
that's right. I think your strength.
And so it bugs me. It bugs me. And I feel that same way about the prison system because of Eileen. And I got kind of sucked into that world a little bit. And as soon as you start to look at what's happening there, it is the most depressing, sad place, just like an animal shelter, where you just see line after line of person who, yes, there are a whole bunch of people who really deserve to be there. And I am in support of the idea of the prison system and the idea of the death penalty. But particularly the way the prison system is in the United States right now, there are so many people who there was a better way to help these people to change their life, or there's, they don't, they should, they're in there for too small of a thing now, or their act was misunderstood. It's like,
how would you, if I made you emperor, and this is always an unfair question a little bit, but if I were to make you emperor, how would you fix, if you could, the prison system or the injustices? Because part of what your strength is as you're talking, I'm realizing, and I certainly think what drives me, and I know what drives you, is that your heart breaks very easily when you take a look at the world. I mean, I feel so lucky. You and I live in such a great place, and it's sunny, and it's nice, and it's safe, and we can speak our mind, and you don't have to see a lot of suffering. And when you do, you know, maybe because I grew up all over the world and I know you grew up all over the place, you are more in tune with how bad it is for some people. And you know, I remember being in Afghanistan, I went through the hospitals. And of course, I saw the soldiers and stuff, and that was very hard. But I also saw a three-year-old girl who had swallowed some battery acid, and she had a hole in her throat. Now, she was okay. Oh. But I looked at this little girl who couldn't talk, and I thought, and then I saw a 10-year-old who had lost his legs. Literally, they were lifting him off the hospital, off the operating table. And he lost his legs to a mine. He was 10. He was the size of a 6-year-old, because in Afghanistan, they don't get any nutrition. But to me, it was such a stark reminder that the horror of the life can be so horrifying and heartbreaking. And most of us don't live in those spaces,
right,
thank God. But a lot of the world does.
Yeah.
And so I know certainly what drives me, or at least what I care about, is I don't have the ability necessarily to tell stories that are going to break your heart. But what I do have the ability to do is to be responsible to the opportunities I've been given, white male living in America. So I better be talking to people. I better be doing my part, when my part's probably just to be a jackass and be a silly goose. But your part is to tell stories that hopefully move people to laugh and cry and change their minds.
And I actually really believe in that. And that's why, it going back to your first question, it's been easy to do what I do, because I saw Making Monster how much life force it takes. It takes an enormous amount of life force. And so you can only make so many of those movies in your lifetime. I can. There are those guys that make a movie every year. I am definitely not one of those people, you know? And so I want them to be beautiful things, and I want to be trying. I want to be doing multiple levels of things with each film. I want to say, you know, I have a son, and I want to be able to be saying to my son, I was busy and away from you, not just for money to send you to college, not just for a job, but also because I tried to make something beautiful. I tried to bring something beautiful into this world. So those are hard, you know, hitting all of those things at the same time. Otherwise, I feel like a bad person, you know, like I shouldn't be doing it for my vanity or my glory or even money, because there are so many easier ways to make money, you know, than leaving my son for 3 years, you know, like going MIA, you know. So I think that's what I want to do. You know, I want to make things that I really believe in. I believe I'm doing something beautiful. And like, you know, you're asking about how one would change the prison system. That's a really complicated question. I'm just not educated enough, really, to know what the answer to that is. But the first thing I would say is, you have to get rid of the death penalty. And here's why. Not because I don't believe in it in theory. I'm somebody that if somebody killed my family, I would be first in line to see, you know, that person, you know, extinguished, I'm sure. Emotionally, that's how I would feel. Not because I don't believe it in theory. When there's a serial killer who's killed, you know, 40 people, the society will take that person out. I understand that. The problem is our political system is incapable of identifying who that person is clearly enough. When you have innocent people being executed, and you have so many innocent people on death row and exonerated after execution, you've got a problem. So we cannot be trusted.
It also takes forever to kill somebody in this country.
It's a huge 20, waste 30 of years. Money. A huge waste of money. And it goes on and on forever. And we are not good enough at identifying who those people are. And so the first thing I would say is, you have to get rid of the death penalty. There's actually an amazing ballot to get rid of the death penalty that Safe California is pushing for this November election. So it's important to everyone in California. I mean, if it was overturned in California, it would be a huge victory, because we have one of the largest prison systems in the country, and it's completely overrun. And
so much of that is because of drugs too. I the first thing I would do is legalize drugs and just get violent felons.
I mean,
in
that's
prison.
True, but it's also like three strikes and things. I mean, the amount of things people are in prison for life sentences is outrageous.
It's
and
ridiculous.
Like,
yeah.
I tell people stories about the people I've met and the stories I've heard in the prison system, and people think I'm not telling the truth.
Well, I want to comment on that for a second, because it's very important to keep in mind that you have countless hard cases with people who stole a box of candy and are in jail for life because it's the three strikes law.
Right.
And I want to just, there are a lot of young people that listen to this podcast. And one of the things that they need to understand is that at the end of the day, when you pass a law, you had better be willing to, you better know that there is a whole cottage industry that grows up around that law, and it's very hard to change that law. And laws always have unintended consequences. I'm going to have to pause because we're running low on battery, and okay. I'm going to change our batteries, and okay. then we'll finish this up.
Cool.
You're listening to Patty Jenkins and Brian Callen here. Hold, everyone. I got distracted in my point, but it was a brilliant one. But before we take off, I mean, before I change the battery, that is very important. If you're going to pass a law, it may seem good, but there are consequences to a law. And it's very hard to repeal a law. Look at the Rockefeller laws. Look at those mandatory drug sentences that put people away for 20 years for a very minimal amount of cocaine. And there was nothing a judge could do. Nothing. You went to jail for 9, 10, 15, 20 years.
And that's what's happening with three strikes right now.
That's right. So that's very important to realize. When you pass a law and when you vote for a law and there are a lot of special interests behind a law, you better be very careful on whether voting yes or no is a good idea. And that's where you have to hold your representatives accountable. God damn it, I'm so smart. I hate to change the battery.
Change the battery, bro.
All right, hold. Finish your point on what after my brilliant comment on passing laws.
I was only going to say a continuation of that point, which is no mandatory sentencing. You cannot do mandatory sentencing if you do not have money for a private lawyer. Public defenders are so completely overburdened right now. I just saw a case, somebody who had 300 cases in one. It's Jesus. Like, you can't. Jesus. So people who cannot afford expensive representation cannot necessarily get a fair trial.
Well,
and
I was
you
in
cannot
Miami.
Do you cannot do mandatory sentencing. That's it. Every case
Miami-Dade
needs
County
to be looked at separately. You don't know what's going on
exactly,
in situations.
Exactly. It's got to be looked at on a case by case basis. And you know, this is what happens though when politicians run. They go, "I'm going to get tough on crime. If you do this, you're done for." You know, and
right.
it just creates tragedy. But in Miami-Dade County, I went there, and there were guys sitting in Miami-Dade County Jail, which is a terrible jail, for over a year, sometimes 2 years, before their case came up.
Three
years.
In Florida, the person that I met that we ended up actually really realizing was innocent in Florida jail had been there for 3 years without a trial.
There you go. Without
yeah.
a trial.
Without a
sitting
trial.
In a jail. So what does that tell you? You know, there's a lot of problems. There always is going to be with a huge, massive. But anyway, back to the stories you want to tell. It seems that, you know, there's a lot. There's a lot to talk about, and there's a lot to.
Hold on one second.
This is her son.
Asa, hold on one second.
Asa, hold on. We're doing a podcast, but we're almost done.
Yeah, but you have to be quiet. Can you be quiet? Okay.
This is Patty's wonderful little boy, who's 3 years old, and I love him. You're so cute. You're a woman, duh. You're a woman. Do you believe in advice? I mean, do you have any advice for young filmmakers, young women want to get in the business?
I mean,
it doesn't really mean anything. I hate asking that
question.
No,
the only advice I have for women is two opposing pieces of information, hilariously. One is forget that you're a woman. Don't think about it. Don't talk about it. Don't worry about it. In my experience, yes.
After you're done with this, can I have it?
No.
After you're done with this, can I have it? Hold on, Asa. This is very important.
Leadership is leadership. There's a reason that there have been female leaders of countries, you know, not in this country, but there's Margaret Thatcher, and there have been people who do it. Leadership is a skill of its own, and if you... if you forget that and are a good leader, people will follow, you know? And so I think that if you're projecting into any situation that you're going to be treated differently because you're a woman, then you're already handicapping yourself with that projection. They do treat you differently, but there are pros and cons. So that's the first thing I would say. I think there are things that are much easier for me as a woman director than are than for a man director. And there are certain things that are harder. But so that's the first thing I would say. Forget it. Just don't think about it. Don't be a woman filmmaker. Just be a filmmaker, you know?
Yeah.
The opposite thing that I would say is you know, I feel like it's being a woman director is different. And so you have to kind of decide what life you want for yourself. I do think that the kind of the industry is designed for men who are not participating in child care and things like that. So I think that on the other side of the spectrum, it's you always have to kind of decide for yourself what you want your life to be.
What your priorities are.
Yeah. And
that's,
like what.
That's just life in general.
Just life in general, I'm sure. For all of us. Because now, you know, my husband's participates in raising ASA, and it's changed both of our lives. We both have to figure out, you know, what we want to do and what we don't want to do accordingly. So
your husband, by the
everyone.
Way, being Sam Sheridan, and if you guys want to listen to a great podcast, it's on Red Band's Death Squad. Sam Sheridan wrote a book called The Fighter's Heart, Fighter's Mind, where he went all over the country and fought and then wrote about it. Different martial arts, boxing, Muay Thai, Jiu-Jitsu. And now he's writing a book called The Disaster Diaries, which is basically getting ready for the apocalypse. And I can't wait. It's come out. I just saw that. It's awesome. It's coming out soon.
Yeah, coming out this fall.
Yeah. We'll have him back on the podcast as well. Patty, anything else you want to talk about on this, on the mother of all podcasts? What about religion? I'm always confused about it. How are you going to raise your son? I mean, I'm just not religious.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead, say something. Oh, is that what you have so to say, cute. Asa? That's Asa. He's just saying, Yeah, he's so cute.
Yes.
Yeah, you can sit there. But let mommy answer this question.
How am I going to raise Asa? I mean, I don't believe in one particular religion. I sort of have my own religion, so I'll just raise him. Okay, but we're doing... And what?
And I like jumping around.
Well, I like jumping around. That's my religion
right
there.
That's true. So I think I'll just... It's going to be tricky because already those questions have started.
I know. I don't know how to answer them either. I'm just not very religious, man.
But I feel like, you know, I don't know. What's the difference? Like, religious people answer what they believe. I'm just kind of going to answer what I believe.
Well, you raise your child to be a moral, ethical human being that puts other people's interests and well-being at a priority, right?
Yeah.
And then I think...
And I'm sort of strangely very religious, but I just don't... It's just not one particular religion.
But you believe in God.
I don't believe in... I believe in the Tao, really. You know what I mean? I believe, like, there is a force to the universe. There seems to be some sort of force to the universe to me. I don't know
force.
That it's human or man or, like, or anything like man.
Yeah.
I actually think it's light-based from every... I mean, I, like, read about near-death experiences. And
well, because you just did... You directed... You worked with a lot of cancer patients. I mean,
yeah.
You said to me, you directed that thing with... Who were the actresses
five.
Involved?
With...
it was five.
Yeah,
on
Jennifer
breast
Aniston,
cancer.
Demi Moore, Alicia Keys, and Penelope Spheeris.
Did you get to know all those women?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You had good
awesome.
Things to say about...
All of them.
All of them, yeah. You really liked Demi Moore, too.
Demi was a friend of mine before that a little bit anyway.
And her mother died of breast cancer, I think, right?
I don't know if it was breast cancer, no. But I couldn't like her more. She's one of the coolest, smartest, kindest, truly thoughtful people, really. Like, she really is. She's one of those people who's so very different than the public perception of her. Like, she's such a gentle, genuine person.
Yeah. Well, you said to me, now that you've talked to so many people who have been dying and have died on the operating table, that you're not really afraid of death anymore.
I'm not. I'm afraid of the effect that would have on my son. I'm afraid of missing my family and all of those things that one would feel. But I mean, if you look into near-death experience... Across the board, since Greek and Roman times, you'll see people report something super similar. They just did an amazing study that they wrote about in the New York Times saying that they had an opportunity to do a study on near-death experience, because they there were these people who were going to get this heart surgery where they literally had to drain all the blood from the person's body and shut down their heart. Jesus. And freeze them. And they knew they had to do it, and they knew there was a chance the person wouldn't come back, but they took the opportunity to do a test, and they wanted to prove brain death. They wanted to prove that the series of events is brain death. And New York Times, 2 months ago, did the article. What they proved was the exact opposite. All of these people came back, reported unbelievable intricacies about the outside of the building, the inside of the walls. They had heard everything that happened inside of the room. And then a separate study that they wrote about in the same article was cited how people before near-death experience have incredibly varied belief systems, and people after near-death experiences, almost identical.
Wow.
And they are not afraid to die. And they are all kind of like, cool, man, that was, I get it. And if you, and when you hear those people interviewed, they're like, yeah. I was not dreaming.
Yeah.
That was not brain death. I was crystal clear, just like this. I could see everything that was going on. I was completely awake and completely conscious, not in my body anymore. My body looked totally foreign to me.
Well, you know, you and I just had a mutual friend die, and you went to his funeral, and I was unfortunately in New York shooting a movie because I'm a working actor and very talented, but that's not the point.
Yeah.
No, but our buddy died, and the rabbi said something that I heard a Catholic priest say at my father's best friend's, when my father's best friend died. And he said that, you know, and the rabbi had the same tradition, the same story, and he said, you know, when you're in the womb and you're born, it's very shocking to be out of that very comfortable, serene, yeah, wonderful setting, and then you're in the world, and you're crying, and the air is cold, and you get smacked on the ass by the doctor, and there's all these lights, and you cry, and it's painful. But then, of course, you have a new life. And right, death is often described by many religions, major religions, in the same terms.
Yeah.
You're just going on to another place, and it's a better place.
Yeah.
And why not? I mean, it seems to me that it's a type. Why not think of it as another birth as opposed to another death? It's a yeah, neat way to think of it. Atheists would kind of chuckle at this and stuff, but I like that. I choose at least to live in that world.
I feel like I used to be more open to the idea that nothing happened until I started researching near-death experiences, and that became the foundation of my religion, because I was sort of like, that is very specific, folks.
Mm.
Like, this thing comes to you that is a light. You see your whole life in front of you, but you can feel every emotion that every person in the room was feeling in every moment. And you are asked in a non-judgmental way, what did you learn about love? And people will say that same thing in a variety of ways. What did you give? What were you available to give? What could, you know... And you see your whole life through those eyes, and you can suddenly see when you were being selfish or when you were being whatever, all of these things. I don't know what the point is, and I don't understand anything beyond that, whether it's, there reincarnation, is there not? Yeah. I sort of believe there might be, but
I do think, for me, I keep watching how human beings and technology is changing exponentially. There was a saying by Cameron with a scientist, and said, things happen in decades. You know, development, technology develops in decades, and sometimes decades happen in weeks. In other words,
right, yeah.
In other words, you get to a cusp like the human genome, and all of a sudden, boom, you get a massive development in technology that changes everything in a couple weeks.
Right.
We are on the cusp of that happening, apparently, with several different medical techniques and computer techniques, and how we are meshing with computers. And it raises a very important question. Why? What's going on? Why are we becoming more and more connected? Why are we able to kind of almost have other people's experiences in real time? It brings us closer. It brings us closer to it probably creates a larger well of understanding. We're getting better at solving problems like disease and hunger and things like that. We still face challenges, but it seems to me there's got to be a point to this. You know, even the idea of immortality, where you're going to be able to download memories and then put them into other computers and lifelike robots, and then what does that say about you dying? You're going to be able to live forever. Like Ray Kurzweil talks about this. There's a whole cult called the Kurzweilists. It's a new religion, essentially, saying that you don't have to die. I mean, if you can download your memories and who you are and put it into a biocompatible robot, what does that say about mortality? It really raises very important questions. I mean, and when you can download information into your brain and have access to all the information instantaneously, like Google, which is what we're going to have with lifelike robots or even human beings that are meshed with computer, biocompatible computers, it really does raise a number of questions, because the entire paradigm by which we live is thrown into question. When you want to read a book, you got to take your time. When you want to be a scholar at something, it takes a long time to study. What if you can download that skill right away? What's it say? What is the point of all this? Where are we going? And I don't know the answer to that, but I have to believe in my small mind that there's a reason, there's a point, there's a point to this connectivity, this notion that we are being drawn together under a single umbrella of understanding.
Well, and you know what? My favorite thing to think about within that same umbrella is, what is the definition truly of life and consciousness? Because more and more, like, I really genuinely challenge the idea of what life is and consciousness is, because I'm fascinated by plants moving towards light, and you move the light, you move something away from a plant that it can't see, and it will move the other direction. And it's not just photosynthesis. It's not just whatever that word is for reading light. Like, there are all of these incredible examples of things that we have looked at, like trees that live for hundreds of years that we assume are alive in this way that we completely understand, that then we discover are actually alive on a much more sophisticated way. It's maybe way slower than we are, but it actually seems to be making choices at some point, you know? And so,
do you have an example of that? Or?
Yeah, I mean, they figured out that all of the fungus in the rainforest, you know, that was that great TED talk. I sent it to you.
Oh, that's
great.
How mushrooms could save the world.
And that they're all communicating over hundreds of miles of rainforest. Yeah. There's a communication system. So that's
what
I'm
saying. It's a web. It's a web. It's like the internet.
So that's what I'm saying. I'm fascinated endlessly by the revelation of what we don't understand and how truly connected these things are and how transitory. So any given life form is turning into another life form, is turning into another life form. But, like, where does one end and where does the other begin? Because I was always into, you know, spooky stuff when I was, you know, like supernatural things when I was younger. But then at some point I got serious about it in my 20s and I started writing down. I was like, I know who's calling on the phone all the time. What the fuck is that?
Yeah.
Like, what is that? How do I know who's calling on the phone? It's no more useful than caller ID. But to me, I do believe there's universal consciousness. We're all being affected by it. If you can tell if someone's staring at you, what is that? Hmm. What is that? Why do we not try to figure that out?
Well, I think the human beings have very sophisticated communication techniques.
Exactly, but we're not. But we
communicated way before we learned how to speak.
And
so
we don't necessarily acknowledge that, and therefore we're not tapping into, you know, like when people write the same screenplay. Yeah, I'm sure they do. Like, one's not necessarily stealing it from the other. There is a universal consciousness.
Yeah.
You know, and
well,
I see
that's
it with
what
my
I was.
Son.
That's
he
what
knows
I was
all
saying.
Kinds
you're,
of stuff.
You're making a point that I was saying. Is yeah. That we are. We are, because we have access to so much information, we are becoming way more connected, and we are becoming of one mind more and more. I mean, when you can see, for example, with information, if you're in Egypt and you can see how the other half lives in a democratic society like this, you start to want that shit. And you start to say, why is my government doing this to me? You know, that's information is really bringing us together. But more importantly, there's Juan Enriquez on TED.com. And Juan Enriquez is a venture capitalist who invests in futuristic technology. And Juan Enriquez said, you know, there's been a 78% increase in autistic cases, 78% in the past, I believe it's 10 years, but or I think it's from since 1992, and I'm not sure. But there are two things going on there. If there's a 78% jump, then we're either not measuring it correctly.
Not necessarily.
Or
something's
happening. And when you have all these children being born that are hypersensitive to their environment, it may be, one theory goes that he brought up in his lecture, is that our brains are evolving to our environment, because human beings now are exposed to more stimulus and information in one day than they were in a lifetime.
Right. My mom always says that when I say I can't remember names. She's like, one generation ago, you were supposed to know 300 people your entire life.
That's right.
And now you and I have both lived, how many? I've lived, what, 40 places? And
same
I've
thing.
Met all new people every place. And every film set I go on is all new people. Like, I've
it's not just
out,
that.
Dude.
It's every time you get on your computer, you're bombarded by 50,000 different messages.
Right.
And children are dealing with this. And maybe,
that's
the theory goes, maybe our brains are evolving in real time to match this insane amount of information. So you're becoming, and that's why you have a lot of children born that remember every single day of their life. That is a phenomenon. That's
is
Mary
that
Lou Henner.
More than ever?
Apparently, there are at least, but again, is that because we know how to measure it now?
Right, yeah.
Is that because autism is an umbrella term that affects a lot of different conditions? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And then I also have to throw in, I don't want to be Debbie Downer, but, you know, post-World War II, there was a chemical boom.
Yeah.
There were all of these, you know, chemists figured out how to create all of these new chemicals and also waste byproducts.
Yeah.
And the way to you have to pay a huge fine for disposing of toxic waste, mm-hmm. right? So companies don't want to do that. So the thing that you have to do is figure out a third use for your waste byproduct. Put it into a plastic, you make it into something else, you turn it into something else. So also the amount of toxic chemical byproducts and actual chemical compounds that have inundated our lives. You know, and it's funny because people are like, oh, I've always eaten out of cans. Well, no, you didn't eat out of cans lined with BPA until recently. That was something that they figured out how to do. And no, your plastics didn't contain, you know, it's getting worse all the time. So that also has to be challenged.
Like, I think so. And not only that, but we don't know how chemicals, when they're
the lotions and the this and the that.
When they're mixed together,
the air,
they have
the
another
cleaning
effect.
Products. Yeah. And yeah. And it's, you know, anyway, I think that also our environments are, you know, yes, there was smog before. Yes, people breathed coal dust and it killed them. But we're dealing with a new version of that, which is we're surrounded by toxins.
I think we don't understand. I think that all this stuff is sort of a, you know, I choose to believe that all this stuff is sort of a way of getting us to continue to evolve either out of our environment or with our environment, or to become less biologic and more machine-like. I really do.
I never thought of that because
you know, there is this whole theory on Homo evolutus, this idea that, first of all, we're going to be able to control our own evolution with synthetic biology. Talk to Craig Venter about that. But the other thing is, we are coming up with machines. We're coming up with an artificial eye and an artificial ear and artificial organs that are way better. Way better than what we have. We just reverse engineered a dog's red blood cell. If you can reverse engineer a red blood cell, what the idea is to create a nanobot that does what a red blood cell does way better, that oxygenates the blood 100 times better. What does that mean? It means you can hold your breath underwater for an hour. You can run for 15 minutes on a single breath. That's just the beginning. So if you could put an eye in your body that could see at night or a mile away, would you? You fucking right you would. If you had an ear that could hear somebody swallow 100 yards away, you would do it. And that's literally where we're headed. And if you listen to scientists, and by the way, if you want to see this, go to TED.com and it's under Mind-Boggling Science, again, by Juan Enriquez. If you want to see how crazy this is and how fast this stuff is moving, we already have an artificial light eye that they developed in Holland that can see light and dark. I mean, and it attaches to the optic nerve. So, you know, this stuff is moving so quickly that this is going to happen not in 50 years. It's going to happen in decades. You know, we're already growing artificial mouse hearts and ears and bladders and esophagus. There's a woman right now with an esophagus. They took a cadaver's esophagus and they sprayed that esophagus with her own stem cells. Her esophagus was destroyed from tuberculosis. She grew her own esophagus and she's doing great. There are 14 women in New York walking around with bladders they grew in a petri dish. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's not just the regeneration of tissue, it's nanotechnology as well. It is biocompatible machines we're going to be able to put in our bodies that operate better than the organs we have as it is. And that's going to change. That's literally
where
we're headed. Yeah.
That's wild.
Although,
you know, I must say, and this is again like the downer thing, but for some reason it doesn't bother me. I'm so fascinated by the fact that any given life, and this goes back to the near-death experience, you end with nothing. You know, like there was that great Mike Tyson line that I loved, which was, he said, I used to believe that life was about getting everything, and now I realize that life is about losing everything. And I'm always fascinated by the fact that there are elderly people around us who die with everything having been stripped from them every day. And yet we refuse to look at, obviously, that's the lesson. Mm. Like, that's the lesson. Like, it's not progress. It's acceptance of having nothing is like the lesson we're here to learn. Mm. You arc up, but then you do lose everything. Like, one way or the other, you lose everything, and we're all headed towards it. And it's not a downer to me because I do, as I said, believe that there is something beautiful on the other side. But I really do, like, there's something about, like, oh, man, there's this great show called Wonders of the Universe where this this British program where they talk about the cosmos and planets and, you know, it's kind of a modern, updated cosmos. And there was this great episode about entropy. And it just basically, it's a fact that the sun will die and destroy all of this, you know, it will, that's a fact, that's going to happen.
Yeah.
Like, and the universe, they believe factually, and I don't know enough about it to prove what it is.
I do. Kidding.
There will be cold death, I think it's called, where everything will become, it's entropy. Everything will ultimately become the same. Like, you can't, you can try to fix this as many times as you want. It will end up going to dust eventually. Mm-hmm. And at some point, the entire universe, the whole solar system, everything,
the impermanence, everything has an impermanence.
Because it's all one big chemical reaction that's reacting. And like we see with our own chemistry, eventually that settles.
But isn't that what every religion has always said, whether it's Buddhism,
so that's what I'm saying. That's the message I'm fascinated with. Like, what's that about?
That seems to me, at least for me, what that's about is don't get too attached to anything on this planet and in this dimension.
It's all transitory and it's all equal and it's all the same and it's all.
But isn't fame that way? You and I live around fame all the time, and we watch famous people. We know very famous people. Fame, man, if you don't keep that going, you don't keep feeding that beast, in 3 years, everybody forgets who you are. Ask a 22-year-old who Paul Newman is. And they'll be like, I think I've heard of him. I'm not sure. It's amazing. So it's fleeting. Everything is everything that you kind of strive for. Status, reputation, wealth, health, vitality. All those things seem to go away.
Yeah. And that's all the more reason I think that I have really tried to struggle against the temptation towards fame. Not, you know, like, you know, I'm not immune to all the same glory that everybody else is, but towards knowing that one day none of that shit's gonna matter, you know, like having done things that you believe in is gonna be what matters. Mm-hmm. All that other stuff is gonna mean nothing in not too long. Like, when you can't get up and you can't get around and you're in pain, it's not gonna matter to me that I was famous and got into every party at some point. But it will matter to me that I made something that I believed in and learned something about the human experience doing it. And that's why, like, I do think that there's an important quality of life and like what you spend your life doing, like, to be learned from it, you know?
That's it. I love ending on that note. That's a great way to end. I hope you guys listen to that. That's a wise thing to say. And I like keeping this podcast short and sweet. And you just hit on some great topics. I mean, you were, as usual, very eloquent. Thanks for taking the time to speak on the Brian Callen Show / Brian Callen Podcast / winner of the golden microphone for as designated by the Swiss International podcasting legion of millionaires. So I'm excited about that.
And Barack Obama.
I just get so many. And Barack Obama. Barack Obama actually called me and said, "This is my favorite podcast."
Yep.
So I'm doing pretty well, and I make millions of dollars a year doing this podcast. All right, I'm not sponsored at all, and that's okay. guys, thanks once again for listening to the Brian Callen Show. I hope you learned something. Patty Jenkins, the great Patty Jenkins, thank you so much.
All right.
And you're an inspiration to us all. Oh. She's easy on the eyes, by the way. You might want to check her out. Oh, she's like the best-looking director in Hollywood.
Oh, that's not even true.
That's actually true. All right. Bye-bye, everybody. God bless.